Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, wonderful Earth Explorers. We're so glad you're here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains, our AccuWindow forecast. 86 degrees and sunny, a little bit windy out of the west. The solar wind is the highest we have seen in a few years at 642 kilometers per second. And high latitude sky watchers, if it's dark where you live, go out and look for auroras. A geomagnetic storm is underway after a high-speed solar wind gust hit Earth's magnetic field today. An unstable nest of magnetic fields emerged over the sun's northeastern horizon today, and it is crackling with C-class solar flares. Although the maelstrom does have a small dark core, technically making it a sunspot, it has not yet been sunspot numbered by the NOAA. Listeners with solar telescopes are encouraged to keep an eye on the no-name active region. It's where the action is. Also, have you been to the new SDO website, the Solar Dynamics Observatory? The new cameras are working, and the images are absolutely breathtaking. The 3D imaging of the sun right down on the surface is absolutely stunning. I highly recommend you bookmark the page and go there often. We will have the link at X Squared Radio's website. So if you can't remember the Solar Dynamics Observatory in Google, just go to X Squared Radio and you can get to it from there. Also, the verdict is in. We've been telling you this for a couple of years now. China is still the top holder of U.S. government debt. The Treasury said in a report on Friday. Friday's report shows that China's holdings have declined since the end of last year by $17.3 billion as of February, just a couple of months ago, but nevertheless still remained the top foreign holder with $877.5 billion. Japan, in February of this year, had $768.5 billion, while the UK had $233.5 billion. I hope you see that this means that China sold off over $17 billion of its U.S. bonds in a time when our economy was suffering the worst. You haven't seen anything yet. There were 44 earthquakes in the past 24 hours. Three of them were over 5.0, but the earthquakes are spread out everywhere, from Utah to Fiji to Russia. The whole earth is ringing right now. Could something be about to happen? Also, don't forget, my new book, Remembering the Future, is available in ebook format right now. The printed version will take 58 more days and counting, but you can read it now, and you get a 25% discount off the printed version by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com. rememberingthefuturebook.com. And don't forget, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. All kinds of people following what's going on, including NASA. I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement on the expedition above the Arctic Circle, and also when we're getting ready to launch the first affordable electric vehicle. So stay tuned, and if you're not part of Twitter, just go to X Squared Radio. The last few tweets are right there on the cover page. Shouldn't be any problem to get in there. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. It's a short 30-minute version of the program. And the more you click and the more your friends click, the better our chances are of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word. We need something positive out there. Dr. Amit Goswami was born in India. He moved to the United States early in his career, where he was a physics teacher for some 32 years at the University of Oregon Institute for Theoretical Physics. He is convinced, along with a number of others who subscribe to the same view, that the universe, in order to exist, requires a conscious, sentient being to be aware of it. Without an observer, he claims, it only exists as a possibility. And he is our guest tonight. Welcome to the program, Dr. Goswami. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
This is an amazing privilege for me and also for the listeners. I have long been a fan of your work, and I very much appreciate your approach and your awakening. I want to start here. You know, when people think about physics, some people have nightmares about the math they faced in high school or college. But there really are two ends of physics, two camps, as it were. On the one hand, we have the world of possibilities in the very small, where there is no gravity, and we have the world of possibilities in the very large, where gravity is evident. It is more acceptable and perhaps more experimentally evident to assert that consciousness has, at the very least, an effect on changing matter for energy. At first consideration, it seems maybe less agreeable that the same presence has an effect on planets and suns. But what do you think?
Well, actually, you know, this matter, energy, planets, sun, gravity, all forces, this is all matter. Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that matter, energy are all just matter. What name you call it hardly is relevant. So what quantum physics is saying is something drastically different. Quantum physics saying that everything, planets, stars, whatever have you, whatever matter in whatever form, including energy, they're all possibilities for consciousness to choose from. So without consciousness choosing, all the universe, material universe, remain just that, possibility. When we choose our experience. Along with ourselves, we create the universe.
Ah, so consciousness has an effect on everything. Now, you have said that the current worldview has it, that everything is made of matter, and everything can be reduced to the elementary particles of matter, the basic constituents, you know, quarks, as it were, building blocks of matter. But are these really the building blocks of matter, and is this matter all that makes up the universe?
Exactly. That is the point, and quantum physics is saying that they are only part of the universe. Indeed, universe requires these possibilities, material possibilities. But there is much more to the universe than that. First of all, the possibilities remain possibilities without consciousness. So consciousness is needed as the ground of being. The possibilities must belong to a conscious, basic conscious being. Consciousness is the ground of being in which matter exists as possibilities. And then, since we are positing matter as possibilities of consciousness, immediately our mind becomes free to include mind also as possibilities and our vital energies that we feel and even archetypes that we intuit. So now the position that I take is that consciousness has four compartments of possibility. We really live in four different worlds. One world is the material world, which we sense, but then there is another world of vital energies that we feel. Then there is the mental world of meaning that we think, and then the archetypal world of archetypes such as love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness that we intuit. So we are made of four different bodies in all these four different worlds. We are much too limited in the material worldview, and this limitation is making us more and more limited. You know, all this stuff that we suffer from today, I really believe that they're fundamentally coming because everybody has become more limited than they are and narrow, and their narrowness is striking. No, I mean, just compare 50 years ago. I mean, Americans, they're suffering from a very myopic narrowness. start helping anyone.
Well, I can tell you just by looking around that the narrowness is only in their mind. It's not in their backsides.
You
talk about consciousness probabilities. You know, I meet all kinds of people. Some of them realize that they're conscious, and others don't realize that they're conscious. They think that everything is handed to them with no choice, and life is some kind of irrevocable destiny. But there is some causation to consciousness and matter and the universe, is there not?
Yes. Matter has causation. That's the material causation, and that causation gives us possibilities. And consciousness has causation. That's the causation that gives us choice from possibilities and gives us conscious experience. So in this view, the material causation, which we call upward causation, because cause rises upward from elementary particles to atoms, to molecules, to cells, to us, to the brain. But there is also downward causation, which is conscious choice from the possibilities offered to consciousness. And we pick the particular facet of possibility that we want to be our experience in that particular observation. And that's how the manifest world comes to being. There is the unmanifest consisting of possibility, and then there is the manifest. This explains the tremendous insight that Freud and Jung had in the last century about our unconscious, the world being unconscious and conscious. Materialists have no explanation why the world is split between unconscious and conscious. Finally, with quantum physics, we are understanding this basic psychological wisdom.
Well, you talked about downward causation, that of free will being exerted upon entropy, but what is upward causation?
Upward causation is the causation of matter, material interactions that produce all these waves of possibility for consciousness to choose from. So we need upward causation because that gives us variety of properties and attributes and aspects that matter presents to us constantly. Matter is as essential part of this description as is consciousness. Without matter, the manifest world could not exist. But without consciousness to choose, the world would again be unmanifest. So we need both matter and consciousness.
Well, that's stunning in and of itself. But when we think about, well, I was going to say, at least from a physics point of view, we have traditionally thought that free will did not exist, but that's the current
paradigm, that's the material,
right?
Material view. Free will doesn't exist. In our view, free will very much exists, and what it consists of. It consists of choosing from quantum possibilities.
Well, do you think that there's some sort of teleology to the design of the universe and the function of energy?
Thank you for mentioning teleology. Absolutely. If it is consciousness that is the ground of being, why is the manifest world at all? Manifest world is built for the purpose of making the unconscious conscious. I mentioned unmanifest and then the manifest. So manifestation proceeds in time from the unmanifest. Unmanifest are all the possibilities, all the meaning, all the archetypal goodness, love, and all that. And that has to gradually manifest in the manifest world. So we have evolution. Evolution is part and parcel of the manifest world. Manifest world would have no meaning if there were no evolution. But this evolution is not Darwinian. It's a purposive evolution of consciousness itself. The proof of that is that there are gaps in the biological evolution, the fossil gaps, which you cannot explain unless you include creativity. And creativity is a property of consciousness. Matter does not have creativity. Matter cannot have creativity.
So you think these leaps in consciousness might be directly responsible for leaps in biology as well?
Absolutely. Leaps in biological evolution. And those leaps are the ones that has produced us. You know, we began with a single cell 4.5 or something, some billion years ago. And then this life has evolved, becoming multiple cells, becoming all the invertebrate and eventually vertebrate, and then mammals, and then primates, and then finally us. what a brilliant progression. But this progression required the quantum leaps of consciousness.
So the leaps in what we call irreducible complexity is really a demand, a choice of the consciousness inside that being.
Yes. Yes, I'm glad you used the word irreducible complexity. I love it. This is Michael Behe, a great biologist. He's coined the term first. But, this is also the essence of holism, the whole that cannot be reduced to its parts. And it is also the essential component of the quantum theory, where we bring in the concept of tangled hierarchy. You cannot make a tangled hierarchy by simply building it step by step. So the same idea of irreducible complexity is now approached from three different views, and all the views have solidly this concept, and it is required to explain the intricacies, various intricacies of evolution. There is just no doubt about it. And the existence of this irreducible complexity or holistic ingredients or tangled hierarchy proves that consciousness is involved, purposiveness is involved, creativity is involved in biological evolution. Darwinian theory is only part of it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, just natural selection can be observed all over the planet and inside species, but you don't really see, wholesale changes in, for instance, winged lizards or something like that, because they want to get from one island to another. But I have seen, and at least there is some anthropological evidence, that modern man is evolving. We are seeing a difference about every 100 years in the mental and physical capabilities of human beings.
Especially mental. The evolution of human beings mostly is in the way that we process meaning, mental meaning. So, for example, when we are hunters and gatherers, the anthropological data really says that we are giving meaning mainly to the physical world. Then with the invention of instruments such as hoe, agriculture started small scale first, and that's when we started giving meaning to vital energies. This is called the vital mind. And then we developed the rational mind, which is what is going on right now with the development of the plow, basically. And we have been rational mind for a long time, and it's time to change. And I think that this change is being reflected partially in this paradigm shift that we are talking about, from primacy of matter to primacy of consciousness. And there are many other facets. For example, I really think that the current crisis is not the end of all crises. These crisis conditions are only going to amplify further. For example, the economic crisis, in my view, we haven't seen nothing yet. I mean, we are doing economics. We have distorted Adam Smith's economics so far that it's breaking down. And unless we could take drastic measures, which I don't think we can, unless we change the worldview. So when is the worldview going to change? Is it going to change tomorrow? We are incapable of it. So worldview is going to change in its own time, taking maybe a couple of decades. So economic situation will get worse and worse. And all the other problems that we see, like terrorism and environmental disasters, these are also going to become more and more acute. And then when the paradigm changes, then all of a sudden things are going to get better. And in that betterness will come the new way that mind gives meaning. I think we'll be a much more loving, much more ethical beings in just about a few decades. I really think that these crises are not for nothing. It's signifying a huge change that is coming to us.
I'm smiling here because I'm kind of recalling stories of my own grandfather. It had something to do with hell and hand baskets. And we also are not spending the gross amount of our anthropological efforts on feeding one another, but more on killing one another. So I think when that changes,
yes,
we'll definitely make a leap. You made a reference to entanglement. I want to talk a little bit about entangled particle theory because we'll lay a foundation here, and then we'll make a big jump in the next hour and bring all this around science and spirituality all woven into one. Tell us a little bit about entangled particle theory. We hear it from non-physicists all the time, and I think sometimes we get off track. Can you tell us what that involves?
Well, there are several concepts here. The one that you are referring is called entanglement or correlation. This is an aspect of a phenomenon called quantum non-locality. Ordinary interactions, material interactions, they proceed locally with signals. So we call them interaction with the exchange of energy or signals. But in quantum physics, there is an interconnectivity that allows one to communicate without any signal. We call it a non-local quantum connection or correlation or entanglement between objects who can communicate non-locally. So it's the ability of objects to communicate non-locally that is the idea of quantum entanglement or quantum correlation. This is absolutely a very essential component of the new physics. It is also a very essential component of our spirituality, essential component of our creativity. In other words, all the things that matter isn't. Matter is incapable of non-local communication. Material interactions don't permit non-local communication. But with quantum physics, because everything is embedded in a non-local consciousness, this non-local communication is permitted. Not as a property of matter, but as a property of consciousness. Non-locality is an inherent aspect of consciousness. And so what you were asking in terms of quantum entanglement, that is one of the fundamental new phenomenon that is opening us to new possibilities, new potential that we have not known before. This is fantastic.
I think it's amazing that new fundamentals are entering a science that's already so old and has had such brilliant minds behind it for well over 100 years, but we are now seeing new fundamentals. when we talk about entanglement, we talk about these two particles reacting non-locally. Are there any thoughts about whether there are two particles somehow linked to one another, like an irrevocable Pauli exclusion, or are they actually the same particle existing in two locations at once?
Yeah, well, you know, how are the two particles? Their interaction just triggers this non-local connection between them. The non-local connection is inherent. It's a connection to consciousness. This is the way that they interact. They interact because they are one. They ultimately are connected, but not through space-time, but through the oneness that they share with consciousness. They are both possibilities of consciousness, and therefore consciousness connects them. So if you think that way, then all paradoxes disappear.
But when my brother first told me about this, he was a dean of physiology at Johns Hopkins for, I don't know, 20 years. When he first told me about, for instance, the aspect experiment, I had a hard time believing it, at least from a scientific point of view. But when you throw in, shall we call it, the consciousness constant, then it really gets spooky.
Yeah. It's spooky, all right. You know, this is what Einstein called a spooky action at a distance. He never could believe it. But, of course, it died long before a space experiment was performed. If a space experiment was performed during Einstein's life, then I wonder how Einstein would have felt. He would have such a radical change of worldview all of a sudden. You know, that would be fun to watch.
Well, that's true, and he had so many benchmarks, and he was a consolidative physicist. There were many experts, but they couldn't speak in a consolidated way where the public could actually understand it. But Einstein was a master at doing that. And he had several benchmarks that, you know, as experiments with astrophysics got better and better, it proved out his theories almost exactly.
Yeah, much of it, absolutely. And one of the things that Einstein always had, that experimental data, as soon as experimental data came out, he wouldn't fight it. He would immediately accept it and he would try to understand it. This
sure.
is one thing that currently all the physicists, they cannot do. They are so inflexible. Experimental data is now clearly showing that we need downward causation, we need consciousness to understand quantum physics, understand the world as we know it, as we experience it. But these physicists are completely blind to it. They deny experimental data. You know, today we have data where one person meditates and another person with another person with the intention that they will have non-local communication. Then this person sees a light flash or a series of light flashes. And somehow this brain activity of this person is transferred to the other brain, as shown by electroencephalogram machines which are connected to both brains. And both brains show the same kind of brainwave signals. How can that be? How can electrical signals from one brain get to another without an electromagnetic connection? So, you know, even in view of this kind of experiment, which has now been repeated 4 or 5 times, replicated in different laboratories, even then these scientists are completely blind to them. They decide not to engage with it and retain their faith in materialism, scientific materialism, that matter is everything. And so much publicity, you know, this news media is another problem. Of course, your radio show is an exception, you know. Most of media, similarly, ignores the paradigm shift that is going on. That explains so much more, and we already have technologies even. But still, this is a frustrating state of affairs.
Yeah, it is. One of the things that it's really in the news, and I think it's been at the top of the paranormal news for a long time, and that is in the local view of the universe, the speed of light is the limit. And when we think about the speed of light as the speed limit of the universe, the advent of different races communicating across space becomes very improbable.
Yeah, in fact, the question is really becomes moot, in my judgment. We should not even raise such issues. Is there extraterrestrial intelligence? Because how are you going to communicate with them staying within the speed of light limit? But non-locality puts a monkey wrench in all of this kind of consideration. It makes us into citizen of the galaxy, citizen of the universe, instead of just being citizen of the Earth. This issue alone should change the paradigm.
Sure. Yeah, the idea that evidence shows up experimentally or empirically that doesn't fit the paradigm of the current religion of science, so they just throw it out, stating unequivocally, at least my astronomy friends say, UFOs don't exist because it's impossible to travel across the expanse of space, even at the speed of light. Well, their premise is flawed, so their conclusion is flawed.
Yes.
Well, I have a question. The distance of space, what does it look like from the perspective of a photon, say, emitted on the star Arcturus, for instance, as it looks toward Earth? What does space look like to the photon?
Well, this is a good question. For the photon, because it moves exactly at the speed of light, space contracts away completely. You know, there is a phenomenon called Lorentz contraction. This is within the theory of relativity. So if you are sitting on a photon, which is, by the way, impossible for a massive object, but if you could sit on a photon rocket, then space would disappear for you in the forward direction, in the direction that you are moving. So a photon, in a sense, can move instantly in its own time from one point of space to another. But since nothing else can ride a photon rocket, therefore the question is moot. If we could melt away all space. And also space doesn't melt away in every direction. It's just in the direction of movement of the photon.
Well, then it's just a question of observation. One
question
sees
of
the
who is looking at from where. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. So time is the difference, or should we call it distance? I mean, what is the math?
Distance and time can be interchanged in the theory of relativity to a certain extent. This is why time is called the fourth dimension in the theory of relativity. it's not really a fourth dimension in the sense that time and space cannot be completely interchanged, but in a certain situation, it can be partially interchanged. And this is why, for example, if we go on a high-speed spaceship near to the speed of light, not even has to be exactly the speed of light when time disappears completely, and we can make a trip instantly. But even when we go at a very high speed, close to the speed of light, we have a phenomenon called time dilation. Time clocks slow down. So in my own time, on the spaceship time, I won't age as much as my cousin on Earth will have aged in the same time.
Well, that's exactly right. If we think of it in terms of traveling an amount of time at that speed, but if time is distance and we really are making space local by slipping in between space-time, then we're not traveling any distance or time at all.
No, exactly. This non-locality is wonderful because it really is instantaneous communication. So now, through non-locality, although we cannot move massive objects, but we certainly can communicate across space and time without spending any time at all. And that gives us all kinds of new phenomena to be experienced in the psychological dimension, not necessarily in the physical dimension, but at least in the psychological dimension.
Well, I like that because it allows us at least the opportunity, the possibility to observe at a distance that we couldn't think about before.
Or even experience at a distance. You know, some of this phenomenon of UFO, we sometimes throw them away offhand because they seem so outrageous. But when you think of them as psychological experiences of people, then it does not seem so outrageous. They could just be another aspect of quantum non-locality. We just have to imagine much more than we are capable of today. Because of materialism, our imagination has also become very narrow. If we broaden our imagination, then it is not hard to imagine models of psychological models of communication between human beings and extraterrestrials. The problem arises when we want to make a movie. There, of course, we have to have physical stuff and spaceships, and you know, that's where things become incredible, and we can laugh at them. But it, on the psychological dimension, on the other hand, non-locality allows us such wonderful depth and breadth of phenomenon that it's really worthwhile investigating and worthwhile imagining in those terms.
Well, maybe that's why we need science fiction, because it allows us to at least psychologically accept the impossible and then manifest beyond that.
Yes, I completely agree.
Well, is there an effect from things outside space and time on things inside space and time?
Well, actually, the possibilities are all outside of space and time. Non-local consciousness.
Ah.
And then when we choose, we create space and time along with the objects of manifest world. So now what is outside, the potentia, becomes our experience that we frame to be part of a space-time world. But what we see is a projection. It really can be called a projection of consciousness. Consciousness projects space and time from the possibilities and constructs this material world to be situated in that space and time.
Well, so what we're saying then is then there's an outside observation occurring along with our third dimensional reality.
Yeah, the observation itself. But here is the really startling accurate statement that you can make, which is a little paradoxical initially, but when you think about it, this is the only way it has to be. Consciousness is everything. It's the ground of all being. Therefore, in order to see itself separate from itself, it literally has to split itself up into a part that sees the other part as an object. So the subject and object, we observe with his brain, is simultaneously created as the world that we project to be outside of us. So So this is called in Buddhism, you know, in spiritual traditions, we have imaginations like that. So Buddhism has a concept called dependent co-arising. Quantum physics, after 2,500 years later, has discovered the same thing, that consciousness becomes the subject and object which co-dependently arise, making this manifest universe of experience possible. Experience requires a subject and also an object. If the world were just objects, there would be no experience, because objects can only make objects. So this is the first curiosity, philosophical curiosity. How does the universe have experience, which requires a subject? It can't. So in materialism, there is no experience, and quantum physics agrees with it. There is only possibilities. So how do possibilities become actual events? It becomes actual event because of dependent co-arising. Consciousness literally splits itself up into a subject that looks upon itself as separate from the rest of the world, the objects. So in this way, consciousness becomes both the subject which is experiencing the world and outside of itself. That outside that you refer to is a creation of consciousness. In effect, everything is really inside of consciousness, but in the process of creating us as observers, we create also the world that is outside of us.
I got it. So is this the observation of us in another dimension, or is it the observation of God, or is it simply the rippling consciousness of another dimension?
Well, you can look at it from both perspectives. From the perspective of outside of space and time, the objective perspective, it is really God's creation. But from the perspective of us, we are creating the world, except that we are creating it codependent with the world. So we can say literally that we create the world and the world creates us.
Yeah, we're kind of like working managers. We're managing the world in which we're also dependent upon the peas and carrots that grow around us. So we kind of have to take care of it all, ourselves and the world. It kind of takes us back to, I find it interesting that science is finally getting smart enough to catch up with the ancient masters. They already had all of this figured out, just in different terminologies, and now we're trying to put mathematics behind it and explain it. But it is a slow-changing religion, this modern science, is it not? Oh, did I lose my guest? That's a possibility. He can hear me and I can't hear him. And maybe you guys can hear him, but I can't hear him. Are we there? I'm live. All right. He's checking the guest right now. All right. When we talk about observation and we talk about being aware of ourselves, observing and also managing our creation, which we call life, we are also part of that life. So if we get too busy with our nose to the grindstone, we kind of forget about the creating part, and we stop being involved as creators. We stop being responsible as creators, we start falling into the paycheck to paycheck thing, or we start feeling too material, where we have to worry about what car we drive or what home we live in or what clothes we wear or how many digits there are in our bank account, but we're not involved in the creation. And I guess maybe if you look back on it, if you were to look at, say, your high school graduation picture and then look at a picture of you now and try to really understand how much experience, how much time has gone between the two photographs, I think you'll be shocked to realize it's only been a few moments. All right, you're back. We were just talking about this observation and management of a creation in which we are part of the creation. So we're kind of participating working managers in the creation.
And what participation is very significant. We participate in the world. In other words, we are part and parcel of the creation. Without us, there is no creation, just as creation is intended for creating us. So it's you know, John Wheeler, a great physicist, used to call it the meaning circuit. We complete the meaning circuit. Otherwise, there is no meaning to this world. We are the ones who can impose a meaning on whatever has taken place or is taking
place.
Well,
I know, but we're trying, at least the world is trying to convince us that meaning means, you know, an effective, healthy, comfortable retirement.
So
the reality is there is no separation. No matter how much we try to think there is, we are all one, are we not?
Yes, we are all one, but within that oneness, the diversity of the manifest world is created because we want to bring aspects of that oneness, namely those fantastic archetypes, love, beauty, justice, truth, and goodness, and so forth, which reminds us of oneness. We want to bring those qualities in separateness, in the manifest world. So manifest world is created in such a way that it evolves towards is oneness. Oneness is not just a concept of being one, being capable of non-locally communicating, but oneness has this capacity of bringing together these fantastic concepts, making it manifest. Like, you know, you can love another person separate from the person. At least you can make love. You can have sex with a person who is separate from.
Well, you know, one would have to also surmise that if that outer observation can affect us.
Of course, it's the reason that we are so driven, committed to love itself. You know, so many people search for love almost all of their lives. Why do we do it? Because we want to manifest the non-locality of love in our life. So non-locality or oneness is more than just being one. It's also manifesting that unity in the diversity.
Wow. That has a lot of ramifications. That means that not just those actions, but other actions that we partake in or that we instigate have an effect on the universe.
Yes, absolutely. In other words, the universe is created with this idea that eventually will manifest all that is unmanifest, all the great beauty that is unmanifest initially. But that's why we move towards these great archetypes. Our whole movement of consciousness is designed to manifest these great archetypes. Just the very thing that you were saying, that in 100 years, our perception of these things changed so much. And 100 years from now, you know, today we are so divided. 100 years from now, we'll be much less divided. And if you look at 100 years before, indeed, we were much more divided. So in this way, we evolve towards more and more unity as manifest in diversity. Not only unity in possibility, but unity in manifestation.
Well, I've got that. Now, I mean, this sort of, wow, this really opens the possibilities. It means that the atomic bomb China closet condition is in the forefront. If we go around killing and breaking things, these energies of fear, hatred, and obfuscation can have an effect on the entangled universe.
Absolutely. And they try to keep us from manifesting this entanglement that we were talking about before. Because as soon as these negative emotions come to us, immediately we feel separate. We are separate. We become separate because we refuse to look upon those things, those attributes of consciousness like love and beauty and justice, etc. That will unite us once again. So it all depends on where you are in our evolution. I believe, and the new science vindicates me, that we reincarnate many times in our lifetimes. We have had all of us have had many lives together, or we may not have been together all of our lives, but I distinctly suspect that you and I have spoken before in another life. And what happens during all these lives? Well, we move towards better and better manifestation of these archetypes. In other words, we have a purpose that we live. We live the purpose of manifesting these archetypes in ourselves. So as a result, as we move on, depending on our evolution, depending on our reincarnational history, we manifest various degrees these positive emotions. And as we manifest positive emotions, we can balance the negative emotions to a certain extent. The negative emotions are very problematic because they represent brain circuits in us. And when we fall into these brain circuits, it's really quite difficult to get out of it. I mean, what I'm talking about. When you are an angry person, it is difficult to get out of that anger and to, love your enemy, for example, which is one of the teachings of Jesus. Well, it's easy for Jesus to say, but it is very difficult for an ordinary mortal to be in that throw of anger, like, the Tea Party guards right now, and all of a sudden, love the rest of us who are telling them, well, look, don't be so angry, don't be so angry. It's not easy because these brain circuits torment you. So what one has to do is to develop positive emotional brain circuit. But it's difficult. So we need to shift the paradigm, that at least to show these Tea Party goers it's important to have positive emotions. It's important to make brain circuits that will enable you to balance some of your negative circuits so that at least you know what it is to be neutral, if not loving to another person.
Well, when we talk about the spirituality of physics, or we talk about consciousness and its root being in matter, we're really splitting this science wide open. I look at the CERN collider right now. We're basically slamming protons into one another and watching them come apart, and we have all kinds of detectors in the room around this collision, trying to detect all the various frequencies, even if they only exist for a billionth of a second. And it's one thing to slam matter apart and see what it's made of. It's another entirely to gather up all those frequencies and try to make a single proton.
Well, that part is left to the material interactions themselves. And we don't have to do anything, of course. But the way the proton is made is that the quarks are forever confined. So when these objects collide, you literally will never have elementary particles like the quarks coming out. You will always will have protons and other elementary particles which are made of quarks, but quarks cannot come out. So there will always be only these elementary particles coming out. Along with their hope is that some new particles will come out called Higgs boson, and that will give us a support for the theory that we now have for these elementary particle interactions. But these are really, very speculative theories at this time. Nobody knows if the CERN accelerator is really going to produce any new data that will give us new insight. In
sure.
fact, most people I talk to, but of course I talk to more skeptics than believers, there is the strong belief that this has been a boondoggle and red herring, and nothing much will come out of these things.
Well, it's kind of like the movie Contact, where S.R. Haddon said, why build one when you can build two at twice the cost?
exactly. The whole point is, it's a bit unfortunate because, we have very, very intelligent people, these very, very great physicists and engineers and technologists who are employed in places like Stanford, Harvard, great universities. And, the paradigm is over. Material paradigm, its limits are very clear. But these people have been trained in doing this high mathematics and high physics, and so they just cannot make up their mind to do something else. They could, of course. They're so brilliant, they could easily. But inertia is too much to take them in the same direction, so they cannot just give it up. You know, it's like a monkey. Have you ever seen a monkey which puts its hand in the bottle of candy and then grabs the candies, and because it's now made a fist, it cannot pull out its hand anymore because it cannot let go of the candy. It will have to have the fist, so it just cannot get out of the bottle, cannot get its hand out of the bottle. And these scientists seem to be like that, because they have grasped the candy, which is these machines and high expensive living and all this, and they just cannot let go and look at something else, because something else is much more interesting. Life is passing them by, but these experiments, you know, they're not going to lead to anything discernible that they can make, you know, huge theories or any new insights about anything.
So, well, I don't know that's ever been the goal.
I
remember my brother spending years, literally years, writing grants and going back and forth to Washington, because that was the career. It really didn't matter if you discovered anything. The idea was to get the next grant.
Yeah. And, of course, life is so detached from living. Because living is about these archetypes, love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness, you know. But they have not an inkling, because they spend all their time in theorizing and experimenting. And, of course, these things can take horrendous time. This CERN accelerator took years and years to build it, and taken years and years to finally do an experiment. And then it will take years and years to analyze the experiment. So they keep busy, but they keep busy with such trivia. These are trivia compared to what we have to discover in the domain of consciousness, in the domain of the mind, in the domain of vital energies, let alone the archetypes, which can keep us busy for millions of years and has kept us busy for millions of years. You know, if you count the entire evolution of life on Earth, it's a 4 billion year occupation. Evolution keeps us busy at much more intense level than the scientists even can imagine. But unfortunately, well, you know, they're stuck with their models, and that's the way it is.
Well, but I do see even leaders of fairly prestigious projects like the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory up in Hanford, Washington, I do see them coming around. I see that, you know, this paradox of quantum physics, that they actually see that it might be solved if we accept consciousness as the ground of being.
Good. I'm glad that some of these hard-headed scientists you talk to also agrees to this. We are making some progress. You know how I know that? A New York Times columnist, wrote in a column which was addressed to some of the problems that President Obama was having. And it says right in the middle of the column that you are trying to do so many things. Maybe next you will try to tackle with quantum physics because you want to understand consciousness. Now that kind of comment, I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly, that kind of comment would not be made if the idea that quantum physics leads to deep insights about consciousness has not been around. So it is around, and I'm glad about that. But it is from the basic idea to actually shift the paradigm is a big step. And that big step we need to make, because if we make this big step, then really we make a such enormous inroads, especially in two very urgent affairs, worldly affairs. One is health and healing, this cost of health care. That can be reduced to such an extent if we use the integrative medicine that is this new science is proposing. And the second field is economics. You know, I have a solution solutions will sound outrageous if you are a materialist, but if you heed the message of the new science, the solutions are very logical, not at all outrageous. And it can actually solve the problems of business cycle, these recessions that we have, that we are now getting involved in seriously. And, you know, all these questions of why Goldman Sachs did what it did must be forbidden and why it is completely wrong, and we must have a law that keeps them from doing this kind of thing again. This kind of thing today is arbitrary because everybody is saying, well, Goldman Sachs stayed within law. Yes, they stayed within law, but they did clearly something that is unethical. And then materialists will say, but what is the basis of ethics? This is the problem. In the new view, ethics is compulsory. Ethics is part of consciousness. So you cannot question ethics. So therefore, in economics, if we apply the new view, we immediately can frame what kind of legal restrictions we need to make so that capitalism gets back its free flow. I mean, I actually agree with Adam Smith capitalism wholeheartedly. The market's got to be free, but it's the lack of ethics that affects the freedom of the market, not the other way around.
Well, it's amazing to see that someone's ethics usually takes a mighty jump upward after they put $500 million in the bank for themselves.
Exactly.
And perhaps in physics there is a search for a consciousness constant or a function that will allow this reality into the proof that energies make up matter.
Well, the energies that now you are talking about are different energies. That they are the vital energies that we feel. And indeed, vital energies are manifest in the material part of ourselves that we call organs. Matter and energy, you know, this energy, this word is so confusing because energy usually means physical energy today. But even before the physical energy was conceived, which was 1837, we have always used the word energy, meaning vital energy. And vital energy becomes matter in a way of speaking in the form of biological matter. Vital energy is programmed into biological matter, and those are how the organs function. If we understand things that way, then it becomes very clear how consciousness works in us. We should all be very careful when you use the word energy. On one hand, there is the word physical energy, which is identical with matter. Matter and energy are completely equivalent. There is no difference between them. But as soon as you bring up the idea of energy as vital energy that we feel, that gives us life, that gives us vitality, then the whole aspect changes, and then what you just said begins to make a lot of sense. That consciousness.
Yeah. The physical energies are subject to the laws of entropy.
That's why we feel the energy in our chakras where there are organs. In every chakra point where we feel our emotions, feelings, there is an important organ sitting there. That organ is the manifestation of that particular vital energy.
Right. Well, and we see highly organized, or I should say, conscious direction in the vital energy, whereas the physical energy seems to obey the law of entropy and doesn't normally organize itself into more complex forms.
Exactly. That is the crucial point. I'm glad you brought up entropy. Physical dimension is subject to the law of entropy, and therefore we cannot do very much with it. But if we look at the vital energy. In fact, if we look at the vital, mental, supramental, this is precisely the solution of the economic problem because these are unlimited dimensions where there is no zero-sum game, whereas in the material dimension, we do have a zero-sum game. And because of that zero-sum game, we have competition, we have impossible situations like you cannot have unlimited inflation, you cannot let the unemployment go down too much because then you are going to have inflation, and the inflation eventually cannot go on indefinitely. You're going to have recession. So this business cycle problems is unsolvable when it is a zero-sum game. Whereas if we bring in the unlimited aspect of our subtle energies, for example, then there is no zero-sum game. And we can expand our economy forever in those directions and live happily forever. I mean, the ending ultimately is that if we carve our material dimension of greed and need, etc., and expand our need in the vital, mental, supramental dimension, then we really can be very happy economic beings, because there is no need for competition, because what we are looking for is unlimited.
Yeah, exactly. The economy expands to the point where money becomes obsolete. We're going to take a quick break, about 4 minutes, a quick musical break, get a glass of water or whatever, let our affiliates recognize themselves around the world. My guest tonight, Dr. Amit Goswami. His website is amitgoswami.org. Check it out during the break. We'll be back in about 6 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're so glad that you're here with us today. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians. This month, from the 13th to the 17th, is the Questers Conference up in Calgary, Canada. If you're in the area, why don't you stop by and see us? I'll be speaking up there. And then in July is the ESETI conference. Don't forget that one. It's coming up. Also, Remembering the Future is out in ebook right now. We're trying to make sure we get it in your hands as quickly as possible while we're waiting for the print version to come out. It's about 58 days until we see the book come out in print. But you can get your hands on it now, read it, and in buying the ebook, you get 25% off the printed version. So you can have the autographed version on your bookshelf and the knowledge in your head. Go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and don't forget to catch us on Web Talk Radio. We're making a run for syndication out there. We're still a proud member of the BBS Radio Network, have been now for 5 years. And in the top 1% on that network, and we're proud to be there. My guest tonight is Dr. Amit Goswami. He is a theoretical physicist with a quantum activist mind. And we'll be back in 40 seconds with more. Don't go away. This is X Squared Radio. Better have your seatbelt on. It appears quantum physics is catching up with an ancient idea of dependent co-arising, says Dr. Goswami. We're going to discuss the spiritual aspects of that, where science and spirituality get wrapped up in the same fabric. Here we go. Dr. Goswami, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Question, is the human race evolving?
Yes. Human race is very much evolving. It has passed through... mind has four evolutionary stages. Mind, property of mind is to give meaning to the world. The consciousness, that is the ground of being, has four different worlds of possibility. It's really, we don't really live in a universe. We live in a multiverse. The multiverse consists of a world of matter, a world of vital energy, a world of mind, and a world of archetype, which Aurobindo, a sage in India in the last century, called supermind, supramental. So if you take that into account, then it follows that mind gives meaning to four different worlds. The material is only one of them. So that part of the mind is called the physical mind. We already have developed a pretty good physical mind. You know, scientists today, they are people who are dominated by the physical mind. Everything is physical according to them, many of them. Then there is the vital mind. Many people have that characteristic. Carl Jung actually, found this characteristic, four different traits of personality. People where the vital mind dominates, those are the feeling-dominated mind, according to Carl Jung. Many women especially have that characteristic, but men too. And those are the two phases of human evolution that we have already completed, anthropologically speaking. Not very well, because we still continue to do that, and the vital mind especially has not really been integrated very well. But the third stage of the mind that we are in right now is when mind gives meaning to mind itself. In other words, meaning of meaning. Rational thinking is part of it. So this is also called the age of the rational mind. This is what we are belonging right now. We are developing our rational mind more and more, or trying to anyway, because the negative emotions create problems. Part of the vital mind that is unresolved as of yet creates problems. But there is a next stage, which we have only begun in the sense that the greatest among us, those people whom we call spiritual, they have already started this intuitive mind. When mind gives meaning to the great archetypes, love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness. Ethics was discovered, 2,500 years ago or maybe even longer. But really, we have not gone very far with ethics. Hardly Anybody today, for example, thinks of ethics as something to pursue, something as compulsory. We know about ethics. We read about ethics as philosophy, but we don't really engage with ethical questions anymore because the materialist science that we that our worldview is dominated by, in materialism, there is no scope for ethical thinking. So, but that is the future of the mind. This is what we are evolving towards. We are evolving towards an ethical mind. We are evolving towards an intuitive mind where the supramental archetypes, they will dominate our thinking.
Well, I kind of think about ethics like I sort of compare this to manufacturing. In manufacturing, we used to have lines of inspectors that would go up and down the line to make sure products were being made correctly. And if they were made incorrectly, we threw them in a red bin and ground them up or threw them away or sold them as seconds. But now we approach manufacturing from a different point of view. Now we try to prevent errors instead of detecting errors. And I look at ethics a little bit that way as well. We're trying to write laws so that we can detect unethical behavior and try to make it economically unfeasible to conduct it. What we really should be doing is trying to prevent unethical behavior from the mind side by helping the human being
evolve. That begins with education. That begins with a worldview which has ethics as part of it. Previously, you know, even 100 years ago, we did not have the materialist worldview so acute. We had what is called modernism. We had the validity of both mind and matter, although in a dualistic sense, so eventually that had to go because dualism has its own paradox. But now the point is that we have lost the veracity of mind because of the two equations, mind and matter. We have only accepted the matter as valid. Mind has no validity. Mind is an epiphenomenon of matter. And therefore, whatever mind thinks of, like ethical concepts, that's a mental construct according to this view, and that is not important because it's only epiphenomenon of matter itself. This view has affected us mostly indirectly and much more negatively in an indirect fashion than in a direct fashion. Because in a direct fashion, even the staunchest materialist scientists will not directly attack ethics because, of course, without ethics, our social systems fall apart. Now, nobody will be that stupid. But the point is that indirectly, by demanding that matter is everything, they're already undermining ethics. And this surreptitious attack on ethics is catching up because in our schools, we no longer can emphasize ethics very much. Ethics has become only part of the religious teaching. But who takes religious teaching seriously anymore? I mean, Sunday schools still exist, I suppose, in the Christian part of the world. In the non-Christian part of the world, in some of the traditions, religions are very strong, like in the Islamic tradition. But that has its own disadvantage, you know. It is a peculiar place. Earth has become a very peculiar place to live today because of this complete confusion about the role of ethics in our life.
Well, I can see that because of these four things, matter, vital energies, mind, and supermental or supermind, if some of the pieces are missing, then they're not evolving. They're stuck as, a Cro-Magnon with a suit on.
Very good. Yes, sometimes when people get mad at each other, especially teenagers, they call the other as Neanderthal. I sometimes think of, shouting, oh, why are we moving backwards and becoming Neanderthal all of a sudden? Let's be sensitive towards ethics. Let's be sensitive towards the archetypes. Let's just realize that we are cutting ourselves short when we believe that we are matter only, built of matter, made for matter, made with matter. It just does not make sense, but because matter cannot even give us a simple experience, a subject-object split with which we experience reality. So if matter cannot even explain such an elementary thing, then how can we take the material worldview so seriously?
Yeah, exactly. Now, that's not to say that we're not going to pay any attention to matter. I mean, the factories need to run so that people have jobs, but let's not run factories making buggy whips. Let's run factories making things that are useful to people. I mean, for crying out loud, will we stop making cars that run on gasoline and start making cars that run on electricity? That makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense, but, you know, until we wake up to the fact that we have to do it, we have to do it in order to save the environment, and we have to do it because the environment is not separate from us, then only we can do it. Because then saving the environment becomes urgent and important because it's part of us that we are destroying. But unless that concept arises, we'll always, even in the disaster that is happening right now near Louisiana, you know, even then we are so callous. We are not even thinking that, we need energy to be sure, but we have alternatives. It's not true that we have to dig deep and ruin our environment in these coastal areas in order to get energy. It's just not true that we have to remain so dependent on foreign energy, and therefore the only way we can become energy sufficient is digging these holes in the ocean floor and putting our environment in jeopardy. This is just not true. We can live within sustainable energies. Only thing is that we have to cut down our material consumption and replace that by more of the consumption in subtle energies, in the affairs of the mind, in mental meaning, and eventually even the archetype. In other words, we invest in spiritual dimension rather than the material dimension.
Very good. You know, in your papers, you assert that matter in this reality is merely the possibility of quantum states. Does this mean that there is an average reality, like a Fourier transform of reality is like the peak of population of realities because it has been observed into being?
Well, only thing that possibility gives rise to probability. That is true. You are absolutely right. And there is an average that we can talk about. Many scientists get lost about this average that we can talk about. We can talk about because we can compare the average when we compare experimental data for a very large number of things and large number of events, which is what we do in physics and chemistry. We are always talking about very large number of objects. Even a thimbleful of matter will contain something like 10 to the power 23 molecules of matter, and you can see how large a number that is, you know, in terms of it's like a huge number, you know, a billion, quadrillion objects. So when we talk about such huge numbers, then of course we can get by with just the concept of average. But when we talk about human beings, the average just doesn't make any sense because, you know, does it make sense to say that I had 1.2 human beings or 1.5 wives or, you know, the average concept.
No, but there's an average reality that we all kind of jointly experience, plus or minus our own individual interpretation of it.
We can talk about it, but it does not make any real impact on our day-to-day life because there, you know, we have to deal with single events, and what matters most is the single event happening to a single object, namely me,
right?
We would not be satisfied by knowing that the average is fine. But what is happening to numero uno, what is happening to me in this particular moment, in this particular experience, if that is not happy, then I have to be concerned. I'm not happy with the fact that average is okay, right?
Yeah. Well, what converts the possibility into actuality, though?
Yeah, this is the crucial point. In the last hour, we went into that a little bit. So we have to conceive that it is the observer. But how can the observer do it? Observer can do it only if consciousness is the ground of being and material objects are possibilities of consciousness. So consciousness chooses out of these many faceted possibilities the one facet that he wants to experience. And that's the one that becomes manifest reality for him or her. So in this way, you see, consciousness is introduced in our world in such a way that there is no paradox. There is no paradox of thinking. The paradoxes arise from two kinds of thinking. One thinking is that everything is matter. Then you have a paradox of everything is possibility, what is making possibility into actuality, the question that you ask. Or paradoxes arise if we think that we are separate from the universe. Then the paradox arises because how do we interact with the universe? What is the connecting principle? If it's a signal, it has to carry energy, but energy of the material world alone is always constant. So this is a paradox. How can we communicate then with the world? If we have consciousness that is non-material, it has to somehow communicate in order to choose. So in both ways, you get paradoxes. If you think that consciousness is the ground of being, that is the basic stuff, and then matter is possibility within consciousness, not separate from it, then you said that consciousness is choosing from its own multifaceted material object. And therefore, it can do it without exchanging any signal. And this kind of communication has now been observed. There, this is called non-local communication. Non-local communication is the biggest big news in science. You know, really, it's not the big accelerator that is getting a lot of publicity. It's really this quantum non-locality, which is the greatest news in science ever since 1982, when it was first observed.
Well, you know, let's try to bring this paradox down to what the average person would see. For instance, a chair created by a craftsman or a machine from wood, and let's say it's put in a box, it's shipped to a store where it's bought, and then it grows old and it's thrown away, and perhaps salvaged by a secondhand store and then bought again by a person who is innocently sitting on it playing cards. There is no thought about accepting the possibility it is a chair. It is actually a chair that materialized because of the consciousness of another being in a previous year. So can we claim that the consciousness of the craftsman survived in actuality as the chair for the card player?
Yeah, now you are asking very, very subtle questions. Consciousness manifests experience. So the experience of the chair was manifested by the builder. Builder built the chair, of course. And was builder's consciousness got into the chair? Yes, builder's consciousness got into the chair. We can even say that the builder's vital energies, another dimension of the builder. Builder is not just the material body. Builder also has vital energies that the builder feels. Those vital energies of the builder got correlated with the chair. So when I buy the chair and manifest the chair from possibility into actuality within my experience, like I'm sitting on the chair, I'm feeling the chair, with sensing the chair, and I'm looking at the chair, I'm receiving those optical signals also, and I'm experiencing at the same time the vital energy of this fellow who created the chair a year ago. If I'm very sensitive, I would notice subtle change in the feelings that I had before I sat on the chair. If you are very subtle, you can actually feel the energies of chairs and tables by going to a friend's house and see that indeed your energies change in very subtle ways. I don't know if you have ever noticed it. Sometimes it becomes very noticeable. Like if you go to a church where there have been many spiritual people who have meditated, who have prayed, and you sit down in such a church on a bench, and all of a sudden you are engulfed into total peace. I don't know if it has ever happened to you, but it happens to me many times. This is why people go to temples, people go to churches, people go to mosques and pray, because other people have prayed there. And so when you do that, you feel the energy of these people, all very loving energy, all very accepting energy, all very unity energy. And because you feel those energies, your own mind also quiet down.
Yeah, I've often found places, even though there weren't other people there at the time, that I've walked into and really felt maybe all the emotion or all of the pleading before God or angels or principalities or whatever that's gone on in that place.
Yeah.
And it infuses the mass, the molecules of that place, and becomes part of its energy.
Yes, and this energy is not the physical energy we're talking about. It's the vital energy. It's the energy connected with the life of these people that inhabited those places and prayed and meditated. And that's the energy that we feel, and that energy gives us that feeling of happiness or calmness or equanimity, whatever you may call it.
Well, we often talk about realities being possibilities and really the potential of all possibilities, but do the effects of our consciousness have perpetual actualities that actually reduce somewhat the possibilities of reality?
Well, possibilities of reality are never really reduced in the dimensions other than the material dimensions. In the material dimensions, indeed, there is the entropy law, which constantly is reducing some of the possibilities into unachievable. I mean, energy, for example, as we consume it, it becomes less and less available to do useful work. This
sure.
is the reason that we need constantly new sources of energy. Without it, we cannot function, because we cannot, although energy can be converted from one form to another, but we cannot get the energy converted into available energy, converted into, for example, something useful like electricity. We cannot convert thermal energy into electricity very easily. Thermal energy of the environment, for example, we can never convert. So these are the difficulties in the physical dimension. But you are quite right. In the vital dimension, in the mental dimension, there is no such limitation. This is the beauty of them. How to shift from our overemphasis of the material dimension today to these subtle dimensions is the real question of our society and culture. If we could find ways, we have to. Otherwise, you know, we are really getting into limits of growth. You know, the Club of Rome report in 1970, you know, people, conservatives still poo-poo it, but it's really right. There is limits to growth in the material dimension. And we are now feeling some of the limits to growth. You know, global warming is constantly reminding us that we cannot go on polluting the environment in the search for material energy on and on and on. And we cannot base our economy always based on consumerism, which will always demand more energy. We got to find ways of living that involves more the subtle rather than the gross.
Well, civilizations have a way of reaching an asymptote where either the environment can't support any more human beings, there's not enough energy, not enough land, water, breathable air, and stuff like that. But there's also a technological asymptote where you have reached a point of progress where one of two things is going to happen. You either perish or you awaken.
Yeah, well put. Well put. And we are getting to that place where we are going to be in that crossroad. And I think we'll awake. I think we'll wake up pretty soon. We are moving in that direction. This paradigm shift that we are talking about tonight, is an example of that kind of movement. We are slowly, but surely, we are waking up. It has been a long slumber. You know, William Blake, a long time ago, called this neutron sleep. And neutron sleep did not go away with Newton. It continued on the single vision, and it continues on and on and on in the 21st century, in the first decades. I think it's still dominating us. But I think starting about a few decades from now, we will change, and we will gradually wake up from that single vision and neutron sleep, using Blake's words.
Yeah, I see the change happening now, at least on small scales. And if those paradigms can get some access to capital, where they can actually spread their ability to produce and thus influence more lives, then maybe the change will happen more quickly. I'll tell you what I do see, and I'd like to ask you this question. Do you see the internet, the ability to communicate and move ideas instantaneously around the globe, like we're doing right now, as part of that accelerated evolution, not in the sense that we're all becoming a very wealthy society, but in the sense that we're maybe seeing that we don't need to be a wealthy society in order to evolve.
I'll change your word just a little bit. Yes, first of all, the internet is going to be crucial in this change. Why? Because as we discussed earlier in the last hour, there is this quantum entanglement, this non-local communication between people without requiring any signal. But we are non-locally connected potentially with everyone. However, we don't feel it. We don't actually engage in a non-local communication with everyone. If we did, life would be impossible because we would be constantly communicating with people that we don't know with whom we are communicating. There is so much load, overload. It would be an informational overload. So to prevent that, there is an extra requirement for quantum non-locality. It's triggering. We have to locally, by interaction, trigger the non-local connection. So this triggering is always a problem. Only when I see you, then only we can communicate non-locally, or we have some kind of a connection by prior arrangement. Then we also can non-locally connect with each other. Internet gives us the ability of this triggering to a large number of people at the same time without much effort. For example, the Twitter, Facebook, you know, these are communications between people who have become a community. If I write to my Facebook, I'm communicating with thousands of people all at once, which is then all non-locally, that non-local connection which was potential has now become actual. So in that moment of sending the email and they are receiving them, I am actually potentially capable of meditating together with them on the same kind of intention and bring it to fruition. I mean, imagine the potential of that. So this is the kind of thing that internet has created.
Right, right. So we don't have to coordinate a meditative moment 2 weeks in advance by mail. We can do it.
Right, exactly.
You know, 30 minutes
and,
in advance.
And that has its own problems, too. Mail is unreliable. So, you know, and then here, of course, emails do get lost once in a while, but rarely. I think email is much more reliable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Hopefully the post office doesn't figure out a way to start charging for it. I'll go broke.
right.
You know, I sometimes refer to the mortal body as a biological transducer through which the universe can be sensed. It is limited in its levels of detection, however. Why, I mean, you mentioned earlier that we probably have lived multiple lives, and I too have the feeling that we've at least sat around a campfire or two drawing in the sand on these advanced ideas, and now we're talking again over the expanse of space via the non-local internet. Why do you think that the human body is so limited in its ability to directly sense the universe?
Well, probably it has a reason, because if it didn't, it as I said, there would be constant information overload. So to prevent that alone, we need to have, the brain has limited capacity to process. Many people ask, well, why does the brain have such limited capacity to process? It receives thousands upon thousands of bits of information, but it can process only a little bit of it. But imagine what would happen if it had bigger capacity. I think we'd be completely lost with information itself. We'd never be able to get into the meaning side of it. Information is not it. Information, of course, you know, computers can process a lot of information. But what does it give it? It gives it nothing. It does not have consciousness. It cannot process it. It does not know the meaning of any of the information that we can process with it. But we give the meaning. So if the world is completed in its fullness, appreciated in its fullness, where it's recognized that information is only part of the world, in fact, a secondary part of the world. And the bigger part of the world is how much meaning we can give to the information. Then it becomes immediately clear that we better have information in small dosage, because our capacity for meaning is what matters the most. In fact, if you think about it, it's even beyond meaning. It's those supramental capacities. Ultimately, what we want is the capacity to be happy, capacity to love, capacity to be just to my neighbor, capacity to be good to my neighbor. These are the capacities I want to develop. And therefore, information overload is the least of things that I desire.
Well, yeah, that's true. It is the least of things. And some people get, I don't know, they get trapped in the idea that seeing is believing, and if I can't see it, why, then, you know, then it's not real. If I can't wax it or put it in the bank, then I don't really need it. But when we realize that there's more than one way to observe the universe, not just our eyes and our ears and our nose and our fingers, but hands and senses, but there's a spiritual way to connect with the universe that is quite profound. And even from a scientific point of view, if we want to go and be purist about it, a direct observation is a fact, correct?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Direct observation without signals is a fact. And this is what we have to constantly repeat and repeat and repeat whenever we have the opportunity to other people, our compatriots, so that this very fact, that can, this is a paradigm-shifting fact. That gets around, that everybody knows about, and then they won't think of themselves as being so limited. Because we think ourselves to be so limited, we become so worried about limited aspects, and we start fighting with each other for those limited aspects. If we knew that we have unlimited capacity in these dimensions that we ignore, then I don't think we would be so paranoid. We would not be so so narrow in our behavior with other people.
Well, maybe we wouldn't be so fearful for sure, but it might be a little boring if we had all the answers and could observe everything all the time. There has to be a little bit of mystery. I want to
But it doesn't get boring. I mean, you know, this too is a concept that that has no place for it. Boring actually is a arises from separateness, right? If I am whole with the one, then it is anything but boring. Boring is unsatisfactory because it is a separateness that we feel from the whole. We get bored. But suppose there is no separateness, that I cannot be bored, right? So this whole idea that somehow experiencing beauty or experiencing love all the time would be boring is a misconcept totally. It comes from people who does not have the capacity, and therefore they cannot engage in beauty for a long period of time. And therefore, you know, we think that, well, it would be so boring if we could. But what has happened is that our capacity of looking at a sunset is limited to just that 1 second. And then that capacity is gone. It's an intuitive thing. And in this mind, which is so separate, we cannot intuit for very long. But suppose we could stay in that capacity. We could develop the capacity of staying in that supramental archetype for a long period. Then where is boredom? We would be completely full. You get my gist? You know, this happens to us in terms of one archetype only today. And that, even that is quite limited, which is the archetype of love. When we are in love, people have that capacity. People develop that capacity. And this is why love is so great, because it's our one entry point where we indeed have prolonged periods, you know, not just a few seconds of enjoying beauty, but we have prolonged periods where we can love another person and be full. You know, those stories that are made for honeymoon couple, not even going out for dinner and lunch and breakfast and just having all their meals inside and piles of dishes piling up. You know, that's not, it is partly mythological, but it's partly true also. I mean, we become so full and we never feel separate. So those are very unique experiences of unity. And where is boredom in those states of consciousness? There is no boredom. When you are in love, do you feel bored with it? No, you don't, because you are whole. You are you are complete.
Right. I have been remiss this hour. I forgot to let you all know that the phone lines are now open. If you want to be part of the program, you can reach us from anywhere on planet or off planet at 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161 if you want to be part of the program. If you've been saving up your answer or your question, you can call in and give it to us now, or you can reach us by Skype. Some of you are already texting in by Skype, hence the brilliance of my questions already. You mentioned, Dr. Goswami, in a previous interview that in the Bhagavad Gita, I for some reason got tongue-tied on that, Krishna says to Arjuna, all these things are in me, but I am not in them. That's a little different than the Western tradition. What does he mean by that?
It is a very, 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 very good question. I don't usually get this kind of question. So, but let's engage with it. It's wonderful wisdom. All things are in me, but I am not in them. This idea that consciousness is the ground of being is very important to recognize. But that gives us also the point that everything is conscious. And then we notice, we look at a stone, and we say, well, but the stone obviously does not seem to have the same kind of awareness that a living object has. Even an amoeba, you know, it is alive. And So it is different than a stone. So what is lacking? And then the Krishna's words start making sense. All things are in me. So the object, like a stone, they are certainly within consciousness. Nothing is outside consciousness. So that part is very clear. But I am not in them. So what it means then is that I am not in them, meaning I am not manifest in them. I am not manifest in them. Manifestation of consciousness, that subject-object split experience, that can come only, quantum physics is making it very clear, only if the object has the capacity of precipitating a quantum measurement. An observation or an experience is the result of a quantum measurement, which in more translatable terms, in more understandable terms, is those transformation of those possibilities that we talked about in an actual object, in the manifest object. Objects are possibilities for consciousness to choose from. When consciousness chooses, these possibilities become actual events of experience. And that can happen only if the object that is involved in looking has the capacity of observership. And that capacity is that, we were talking about that in the last hour, that irreducible complexity, tangled hierarchy, that wholeness, that has to be there in the makeup of that object. Brain has it, a living cell has it, but a stone does not have it. So therefore, Krishna is saying this extremely wise, considering that the Bhagavad Gita was written thousands of years ago. It is extremely wise for that time. They didn't have the advantage of quantum physics, but still intuitively, the writer of Bhagavad Gita knew what he's talking about. Namely, consciousness is not manifest in much of the world. But, of course, everything of the world is within consciousness. Nothing can be outside consciousness.
Well, right. I mean, the idea that there is some reverence even for the inanimate, a tree or a rock or a fish, for that matter, there's reverence for it because it does as consciousness, but as far
it
does, as...
It is within consciousness. It's part of consciousness. We experience them as objects, which ultimately is us. So in that sense, of course, you know, we should be very reverential to our environment. That makes sense. But even within saying that, we can make a differentiation between objects and objects that can be subject, that can also have, that with which consciousness can identify. And therefore, consciousness can be manifest. In other words, those objects can become aware of experience. So subject-object split can occur in the vicinity, in the proximity of those objects, like a brain or a living cell, those objects have the capacity of experiencing the world as separate from itself, whereas the stone does not have that capacity. So that distinction can be made without demeaning the stone, without making the stone less than what it is, namely that it is part of the conscious universe, and therefore it cannot be less than that. But it cannot also be more than what it is. It cannot manifest awareness, and therefore it is not, consciousness already has evolved more than the stone. Even in the consciousness of a living cell is greater because it has the capacity of subject-object experience.
Well, some people often say that the universe is folded up inside each and every one of us, and that probably is true, but only in the sense that it's part of our consciousness, not necessarily that it's part of us.
Right, it's part of our consciousness, only in that sense, yes. This is very important. I'm glad you pointed that out. This is very important, and many people have somewhat, this is a slight misconception compared to the gross misconception that the materialist suffers from. But still, this is a slight misconception. We need to distinguish between living, non-living, conscious, unconscious, and all this.
Yeah. In reading a lot of your writings, you can read a few pages and then you have to sit and meditate for a while. It appears there's an axiom, it seems, that if you are spiritual, that you must worship something or work out salvation in fear and trembling before an all-powerful God with limited patience and various inexplicable jealousies. Perhaps spirituality has been forged from the kilns of mortality for you. What does spirituality look like for you now?
Well, it really looks as mysterious as it looked years ago. mysterious in the following sense. The thing is that, spirituality is the idea of transformation to me, to be able to live in a holistic way, live with wholeness as much as possible. What do I find that keeps me from spirituality, keeps me from that creative unity with the one? The negative emotions mainly. Sometimes it is just incapacity of movement of meaning, but mostly the incapacity of movement of meaning comes from the negative emotions. Negative emotions such as just simply lack of love, that completeness, boredom, negative emotions such as moods, that slight uneasiness that comes with it, mood swings. So how to work with them is the big challenge. And how to work with them, I know the theory already. The new science gives us clear indications. Negative emotions can only be balanced with positive emotions, and then if you can balance them, then equanimity of the mind is much easier to achieve. And if we have equanimity of the mind, then mind can be active and agile and looking for the new and be creative, and then mind can be whole, because the creativity comes with a sort of a relaxed attitude of life, which will give rise to occasional insights, occasional trip to the unity consciousness. But more than that, it gives life a purposiveness that makes us always unbored. I mean, if that makes any sense. But boring, right?
Yeah,
So for me, spirituality means all these things, and so it's mysterious because I don't have, I still don't have that complete equanimity that gives you unlimited access to the spiritual dimension of the world. So it's mysterious in that sense. It comes and goes, in other words.
Well, they used to say of us as, you know, we became more and more scientific. That is to say, we employed a scientific methodology about everything and less on faith, that we were atheistic. And maybe to a certain extent that could be true in the sense that, you know, we don't recognize that there's one being that has created everything and then we're just, you know, enjoyment for that being. However, I have found that the more that I learn, the more science that I learn and the more non-science that I learn, I am in awe of the spirituality of it all, not the religiosity of it all.
Yes, and you know, I mean, I laughed when you said this one being of whom we are enjoyment. I have encountered this kind of thinking, but it all comes from thinking of that one being as a human being, the separate being that we experience. When you speak like that, it seems that the authors are completely incapable of thinking what unity consciousness is like. Mm. It's anything but the separateness that we feel as a human being, anything but. It's very far from it. It's a non-ordinary state of consciousness in which there is no boundary. And so this question that we are enjoyment of some person, that question cannot arise. There is no enjoyment. The word enjoyment implies a split, a separateness. I am enjoying something separate from me. Like I'm enjoying a play, I'm enjoying a cup of coffee. In that separateness is manifest and is emphasized. But it's not enjoyment in that sense. It's joy. Instead, it's joy itself. It's not enjoyment. If you cut the ment and cut the end, then separateness disappears. It's joy itself. So when we are in that state of unity, then there is only joy. There is no person enjoying the other person. The separateness between God and me has disappeared. And because it has disappeared, there is only wholeness, there is only joy, there is only happiness.
Yeah, and I think I kind of refute the idea that there must be a balance between evil and good, that good cannot exist without evil. I think it's nonsense. I think good can exist all by itself, and
absolutely,
we don't need evil at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. Good can exist all by itself, and that is what we call God. Of course, evil has a role to play. I mean, what we call evil, which is really separateness from consciousness, from the whole. Good is what takes us towards the whole, and evil is what separates us. It's the opposite movement. Good and evil are movements. One movement is towards the whole, towards wholeness, and the other movement is taking away from wholeness. So these tendencies we already know. We have both tendencies. So good and evil exist within us because we are still struggling. We are struggling to manifest the good within us. And in that struggle, evolution is important. Now, if you look at evolution, you will find that evolution has epochs, and each of these evolutionary epochs began with a geological catastrophe. This catastrophe can be looked upon as the as evil. Like right now, we are approaching a catastrophe. And the evil in this case, you can call the materialistic belief system that we have imposed in our culture and society, that kind of is evil. You can frame things this way. Not necessary, but you could. And so this way of thinking is not bad per se. if you understand in that the evil is just a stepping stone towards good, eventual good, because this separateness has arisen and is arising and is continuing, but it will reach a certain threshold after which paradigm shift will occur and people will be even more capable of moving towards the good than before. So evil exists only because it gives crisis conditions in which we become motivated to be more creative and then create even more good in the society, and that's how evolution proceeds. So evil in this way of looking is part of that evolutionary movement, because in order to be creative, we need a lot of a lot of energy to be generated, to be motivated. And motivation often requires the opposite movement. In most people, they will not be motivated until a crisis has come, right? Motivated towards creativity or spirituality is essential to create a crisis for them.
Well, I don't know if most people would. I think most people spontaneously obey the law and are good and ethical and kind to one another. But there is, you know, a significant portion of our society that, you know, very few things short of incarceration will, you know, change their mind that a life of evil is not a good thing. I hope that society evolves within one lifetime. We don't have to go another lifetime in order to have all those that are perpetrating evil figure out that they've had that experience. Now it's time to have an experience as good. And I would hope that in subsequent incarnations that we don't have to experience evil because we already have. And we're moving forward.
Yeah, well, if you are so lucky. But don't forget, these negative emotions do continue to separate us. So long as our instinctual heritage is not balanced by creation of new positive emotional instincts, we are sort of predisposed to have some of these evil experiences. Until we have created the positive emotion brain circuits in our brain and therefore are capable of balancing ourselves between good and evil. In other words, I'm defining evil as the tendency to go against the direction of consciousness, against the direction towards the whole, against the direction of creating the archetypes in my life. And they come because of the evolutionary history. We have created this instinctual emotional brain circuit, and when we are taken over by them, God forbid, we cannot easily move out of them. You know, it is easy to talk about that. Well, we are, you know, when I'm feeling good, when I'm talking with you in this exciting hours of communication, it feels that we can be totally good. But when I'm caught in that negative emotion, the actuality is that I cannot get out of it very easily. Therefore, we have to be also very humble in the presence of evil, knowing that, you know, this feelings of good does not last very long. We all are taken up once in a while by these evil spasms, if you will. And when society as a whole does that, we get the problems, for example, today's global warming and terrorism. You know, these are signatures of evil in the society itself that is taking us away from evolution of consciousness. But what I was saying is that evolution needs these things, and not in the personal level. In the personal level, I agree with you. Evolution, you know, obviously does not need it. But in the totality, if there is a movement away and creating a lot of crisis conditions, then that, in a sense, motivates a lot more people towards creativity, which is the way to move towards the good, than it would otherwise. And perhaps that is the reason that that evil exists, you know.
Well, I just hope that the humility you're talking about isn't compulsory, and I hope that once we achieve it, we don't become proud, we're humble.
Yes.
That's kind of what we have to think about is the breakthrough where we perhaps change from materialistic point of view to a more spiritual point of view, or we change from a limited negative state to a state of unlimited possibilities. Was there a moment of breakthrough for you?
Well, yes, that breakthrough came in for me in the realization. I was talking to a friend. I was struggling with, you know, this quantum measurement problem, the paradox that how possibility become actual events of consciousness, conscious experience. This was a huge problem for me because in materialism we cannot understand it. Possibility to convert possibility, what can convert possibility into actuality? Because material interactions can convert possibility into other possibilities, never actuality. So, and my worldview at that time was materialistic. So nothing but matter is allowed. Everything is matter. So within that worldview, it's impossible to understand quantum physics. Now, one thing, you know, many quantum physicists are advised, nobody understands quantum physics, so don't bother. But I had already decided that, no, I want to understand it, because otherwise my life is just falling apart. There is so much separateness in my life, I just didn't want to live that way. So I was struggling and struggling. And then one day I was talking to a mystic, and he said a sentence, you know, his sentence was, there is nothing but God. That sentence somehow reverberated in my consciousness and made me realize, the insight came, that consciousness is the ground of all being, and one can do science, a new science, on that basis instead of the old materialist basis that everything is matter. That was the turning point of my life. So, indeed, after that, the struggle disappeared. I knew that the world is friendly. So I was not perturbed by evil or perturbed by negative movements or perturbed by my conditioning anymore, because I knew that overall the movement is positive. And overall that positive movement will manifest in me if I am humble, if I am patient, if I have forbearance. You know, it don't come instantly, but it will come. That faith grew. It is very interesting, you know, the same day that I had that insight, I had the insight at night during a discussion in the evening, the same day I was listening to another mystic, very famous mystic in this case, Jiddu Krishnamurti. I don't know if you have heard about him, but he wrote a lot of book and taught a lot of people, again, in the last century. And I was hearing a lecture. And in that lecture, a heckler, after his lecture, he asked for questions, and a heckler said that you always talk about these things, these states, and you know, this being, and you seem to be completely in that being, but it never comes to us. And Krishnamurti said, with such serenity, it must come. So, you know, that became my faith, that yes, it must come, and it does come every now and then. So I think that if we are patient in our spiritual search, it will come.
Yes, I do too. I think that it comes to everyone who puts themselves in the proper receiving mode. We're going to take a quick 2.5 minute break. We're just running just a little bit long. Don't forget the phone lines are open. We'll enter our last hour with Dr. Amit Goswami. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this.
I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver space. spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome to the final hour of X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians. Things are very calm over here, a little balmy. I hope that the weather is calm where you're at, that the stormy weather has finally passed. Our condolences to those who lost homes and perhaps lives in the bad weather. Those of you that are affected by these things or are emotionally affected by these things, you can do something about it even now and certainly in preparation by finding a way to prepare, that is to say, put together some food storage, some water storage, perhaps some spare clothes in an old book bag or something so that when conditions like this hit, you can get out of a bad situation with enough to eat and drink and wear for 72 hours until help can get there. There's no sense running out in the street in your loafers or, worse, bare feet. A little preparedness goes a long way. Also, don't forget, this month, Questers Conference up in Calgary, Canada. If you're in the area, please stop by and see us, the 13th through the 17th. And in July is the ESETI Conference in Trout Lake, Washington. You can find out more about that, either one of them, by going to xsquaredradio.com. We are a proud member of the BBS Radio Network, and we are expanding into the Web Talk Radio Network. You can find out more about that by clicking on the webtalkradio.net banner at X Squared Radio. We have short versions, little 30-minute versions of this program as archives there. You can listen to them on the way to work if you like. And the more you click and the more you tell your friends to, the easier it is for us to syndicate and get a positive scientific message out there into mainstream. Our guest tonight is Amit Goswami, author of many, many books, and we'll discuss that in a moment. We'll be right back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. Space travel.
Oftentimes we talk about the scientific method and people's eyes glaze over. And when we mention the word physics or quantum physics, they think of famous people with glasses. And, you know, it's not as scary as you think. Certainly getting through the classes is hard. I know physical chemistry was so hard we had a bumper sticker for it, honk if you passed PCHEM. But the concepts are easy to understand, and certainly we're trying to put those out in a conversational way, in a way that you can relate to them, whether you're spiritual or whether you're religious or whether you're neither, just scientific. Perhaps we can break into a new paradigm. And Dr. Goswami, I'd like to ask a question that has something to do with, I guess, the structure of science and the way we study it as a subject in the world. Is there a new way to do science? Can we include consciousness in the way we approach the scientific?
We can and we must. We have to because quantum physics is forcing us to bring consciousness in how we do science. If we do science on the current metaphysical basis, namely that everything is made of matter, and there is nothing in the world but material interactions that are causal, that shape our causality, that give causes for why things happen. then we get paradoxes of quantum physics that we cannot solve. Apart from that, we have much, much, much anomalous data that have collected over the years. There's now a whole bunch of paradoxes and anomalous data, even outside of quantum physics. So the old paradigm, the old metaphysical basis of scientific paradigm is has broken down. It is not noticed by too many people because people have become so fragmented in their investigation of science. A biologist doesn't look into quantum physics. A quantum physicist is not aware of the paradox of perception that psychologists struggle with. Psychologists don't know the paradox of quantum healing. How can a cancer be cured without any medical intervention all of a sudden, instantly, practically, overnight? So what has happened is because of the fragmentation, that is that each scientist convinces himself or herself that everything is okay. There are a few clouds in the horizon, but they will go away with promissory materialism. But they don't go away. They pile up and in various fields, and this is what people have to observe. Quantum physics gives us a way out of this. It defines a new paradigm because to understand quantum physics, we have to accept that consciousness is the ground of all being. And in this ground, there exists not one, the material universe of possibilities, but also a vital energy universe of possibilities, a mental meaning universe of possibilities, and even a supramental archetypal universe from which all those archetypal values, love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness, they come. So in this way, we are building a new science that can give us not only a solution to the paradoxes and anomalous data that I talked about, but give us an understanding of ourselves in such a way that we can move on with our evolution. Our evolution has literally been stalled with this materialist metaphysics guiding us for the last 50 years. So, you know, the part of that stalling is reflected in the social problems, the cultural, international problems that we have, global warming, terrorism, breakdown of democracy, breakdown of capitalism. All these are symptoms of this mistaken worldview. And if we correct the worldview, if we shift the paradigm, when that happens, all of this will be tractable. And the solutions have to come.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I think of Dean Kenyon, who was author of really a best-selling textbook called Biochemical Predestination. A student asked him one day, speak of anomalous things piling up in the corner, asked him where DNA came from. And he thought about that and realized that DNA would have to have been the first protein. It couldn't evolve, couldn't have it evolved. It had to be designed. And so he went back and rewrote his textbook. Because I think he applied consciousness to the idea that DNA did not evolve.
Yeah, it cannot evolve because it requires proteins to make DNA, and without DNA, proteins cannot be built. So how do you build such a, you know, what I call, this is what I call a tangled hierarchy. In a hierarchy which is just cannot be causally built in step-by-step process. How can you causally build something, the living cell, in which there is both DNA and protein, but there is a circular causality between them? How can you build anything with a circular causality in gradients? So this is the problem for materialists, which a material thinking just cannot solve. And therefore, we need to recognize that in consciousness, the possibility of protein and possibility of DNA can simultaneously exist, and therefore, consciousness creatively can manifest both possibilities at the same time, because consciousness does not have to chronologically, step-by-step process, build this thing that we call a living matter.
You know, we've used a word a lot tonight, and I'd like to explore it a little bit in this hour. You were in a film called What the Bleep, along with a good friend of mine, Michal Ledwith. We talk about the word manifestation, and I think it gets bandied about. It gets thrown about. I've even heard it in commercials for new cars. What is manifestation when we talk about it from the standpoint of exercising our intention or marshaling our consciousness in a conscious manner?
Yeah. The manifestation has, you know, the word has been used in many contexts. When I talk about manifestation, I talk about in two different concepts. One is the context of manifest as opposed to unmanifest. Unmanifest is the realm of possibility. And then manifestation just means you are actualizing that particular possibility. You are choosing. Possibility means an object which has many facets. You are choosing one of the facets, and that is the facet that is being actualized. So you can say that the wave of possibility that the object was before your intervention is now actualized, is now manifest. The world was unmanifest, the world was possibility before your observation, and now the world has become manifest because you are having a manifest experience with you as the subject. So that is one context in which I use the word manifest. But there is also a second context in which I use the word, which is in the context of creativity. In creativity, we have the creative process in which we have a process in which we have a beginning of creativity. We call it preparation. And then we have a stage which is very mysterious, but with quantum thinking, the mystery disappears. It's the process that is called sometimes relaxation, sometimes we call it incubation. But the idea is that you don't do anything. Preparation is doing. Here the emphasis is on being. And then the third stage is the stage of creative insight. This is the part which a quantum physicist says it's a quantum leap, a discontinuous transition in thought that has taken place. And then the fourth stage is called manifestation. But here manifestation has the precise meaning of bringing the insight into building a product on the basis of that insight. For example, you have an inspiration and you write a poem. The poem is your product of the inspiration that your creative insight gave you. Scientists builds a law, builds a mathematics of an insight. For example, the apple fell on Newton's head. It is said, and Newton immediately solved the problem in his mind, a problem of gravity. But he had to then develop the mathematics and put it all together in his books or scientific papers. That is the manifestation. Or Picasso has a great idea and then he draws a picture, paints a painting. That's the manifestation. So I also talk about manifestation in that sense. Now, in the way that you talked about, there is a movie called The Secret that takes it even further than even what you need, where the idea is that you intend, and your intention, if you can choose from possibility, you know, the conception arises that you could just intend, and then your choice, your intention, will make that particular what you want manifest. So that's another sense that, you know, not very different from manifestation from the unmanifest. But it gives you the idea that we could just have desires, you know, intentions, and we could manifest them just by desiring them, intending them. In the movie Secret, it is said one more step is added, which is that if you wait for them, then waiting is all you need. Because indeed these things will follow you and manifest the things that you want. They are pursuing you, and therefore they will just come to you, sort of idea. That idea is partially correct, not totally correct. What they omit is that it takes the creative process to manifest. So the manifestation in just intending it is not completely true. You intend and you sit, though that part is true. Intend is like the preparation. It's more than intention. It also requires some work. And then you sit. That part is true. Sitting is important because then the quantum possibilities proliferate. if they proliferate, that is obviously an advantage because you are choosing from a larger pool of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, proliferation helps. And in that sense, sitting, just sitting without doing anything helps because objects are possibilities and possibilities are like waves. They are waves of possibility and waves expand. When you are not collapsing them into actual events, these possibility waves can expand, giving you a bigger pool of possibility to choose from. So, and then, but you then have to have the insight and then you manifest that with actual work. So you cannot cut out work like this. This movie gives you a sort of a, you know, feeling that
you can't just cut out the picture and put it on your refrigerator door and have it show up at your doorstep via FedEx the next day.
Right. That doesn't happen. That is the misconception that one has to remove. It's not that easy. But the part of the movie that I like, which is that emphasis of sitting, just sitting, because in our culture, you know, too many people work too hard to manifest things in their life. You don't really have to work all the time. You really need to sit down and relax, and that relaxation, out of that relaxation, your power to choose improves. But of course, the crucial point here is the creative insight, which comes in a non-ordinary state of consciousness. So you choose, but you don't choose in your ego. So what you are choosing, this is why outcome of the creative process is often very mysterious, because what you choose may not even be the object the way you intended it.
Yeah.
It is an object, all right, and it's a product, all right, but it may not be the product that you intended originally. So the intention is a way of being amplified or being changed in the process of creativity itself.
Well, I can see having a point of focus. That is to say, I'm going to work and I'm going to focus on a certain motorcycle or a certain car or a certain home to buy one day. As opposed to just working and then getting a bunch of money and then figuring out what you want to do with the money. And maybe, as you said, it isn't money that's the way the universe is going to get it to you in the first place. Just putting the idea out there that you want to be a physicist or a dentist, for that matter, or you want to have a certain home with certain shutters in which to live, just putting that idea out there does seem to solidify the actuality of possibilities. But that just means that there's now a point of focus to which to place your energies.
Yeah, it gets the initial focusing. But as I said, the object of your initial intention, may undergo very subtle, sometimes even gross changes in the process of manifestation itself when you carry through the creative process. The thing is that the creative process itself is referring only to the mental process, the subtle. The meaning you give to things. So this subtlety has to be understood. It's never a manifestation in the physical. It's manifestation in the physical, but through the intermediary of the subtle. For example, I can intend for a house, and I don't have the money to buy the house right now. Where is the money going to come from? Am I going to create the money itself? No. I might be with my creative insight, may have a non-local connection with somebody. Maybe one of my relatives is rich, and this rich relative all of a sudden in that non-local momentary connection with me recognize that much good will come out of he or she giving me a bunch of money with which I can buy the desired house, if that is the intention of the non-local consciousness with which connected us in the first place. So it can manifest in that kind of way, but the path to that manifestation was that ability of my quantum leaping to that non-local consciousness, which is the moment of insight. And that to get to that moment of insight, I have to go through in terms of not solidifying the intention so much as to more making the intention a little more nebulous for the greater good. That is a better strategy. For example, there is programs now for quantum healing of people, this spontaneous healing that I was talking about. What works best is to visualize. But if you visualize in a way that your visualization is serving the greater good, then your scope of healing actually increases.
How much of the act of manifestation, whether it's in healing or whether it's in manifesting bounty in your life, how much of the process is listening?
Yes, listening plays a very large role, because listening, through listening, we can become non-local with another person. If it is true listening meaning relaxing, relaxed listening, not listening with stuff that is coming in my mind is going and it's running away and I'm just suppressing the thoughts, not that kind of listening, but a listening with humility, where we are listening as much as possible in silence. That kind of listening is absolutely crucial in getting to that non-local consciousness. In fact, meditation allows us to listen that way. So meditation in a large sense is to learn the art of listening, listening to the whispers of the, of our own, what I call quantum self, this higher self that guides us, or you may call it God, the causal agent of downward causation that chooses from the possibility and gives us the actual event. So listening in that way is creating that openness in us. When we speak, we are clamoring for conditioned stuff that we know. Only through listening do we become open to things that are unconditioned, that we have not known before. And that unconditional aspect of this seeking that frees me to intend in such a way that it can resonate with the one consciousness, that non-ordinary state of consciousness from which I can create anything, I can choose anything.
Mm. Well, we have been told that by greats, even Jesus, who said that there was really nothing beyond our ability if we just had the faith of a mustard seed. Interesting. Science has traditionally been used to dismantle and harness or even consume nature. How do you see science as a way to understand nature without burning it?
Yes. So when science is done within the primacy of consciousness, this new science that we are talking about, then fundamentally we recognize that the world is us. World is not separate from us. When science grew up in its childhood, it had great battles with the religious tradition that we call Christianity, because science grew up in the Western world where Christianity was the dominant force. In fact, Christianity had its own very unscientific science that it borrowed from Aristotle's philosophy. Now, Aristotle was a very great person, but his science was quite wrong. Unfortunately, the science that Newton built and others developed from his physics also had this childhood memory of fighting with religion a lot. And in that fighting, that memory of the battle, they have excluded a lot of the religious teachings. Some of these things are what has become now huge problems with this particular science, this materialist science. That separateness to and on the desire to fight religion, even when religion is talking about something that is right, although may not be in the right language. For example, all religions talk about downward causation because they recognize intuitively that apart from material causation, there must be something outside of it. Why? Because they know that we can transform, we can change. According to the ordinary materialist science, we could never change because we are nothing but the dance of molecules and atoms and elementary particles. then we don't have any freedom to change. How can you change without freedom, without having the free will to change? So in materialist science, there is no transformation. But every person who has ever been religious or spiritual knows that transformation does happen, and it happens to everybody if everyone goes for it, and that is the way we should play our intention. Then they know that there has to be another force in the world, another causal agency. So every tradition supports downward causation. But the downward causation, that image of downward causation, of course, can be very naive. Like Christianity has the image of an emperor sitting on in the heaven in a throne, and from which it goes out its downward causation, doing what? When people die, God decides whether to throw the person, the soul of the person, to heaven, or whether to send the soul to hell. Now, this is a very naive picture of downward causation, but nevertheless, it is downward causation. We should not forget that.
Sure.
And other traditions, of course, have more sophisticated picture. Even in Christianity, esoteric Christianity has much more sophisticated picture of this. But scientists ignore it because of that childhood of antagonism to Christianity. Scientists just are unable to see the essence of spirituality. And this is the unfortunate battle between science and spirituality that is still going on. There is no need for the battle because science can be based, as I said, on the idea of primacy of consciousness. Then downward causation is recognized from the get-go, namely consisting of choice, conscious choice, that collapses the weights of possibility into actual events of experience. And then the new science does not have any battle between science and spirituality. Both are included.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. You know, I see historically, even in the history of science, where science has had a religious overtone to it. We need only think about Galileo or Copernicus, but we also think in terms of Einstein, who wrestled with his own dogma and the experimental information that he was receiving being at odds with it. He literally threw out data or came up with constants to explain it, which were in line with his religious upbringing and his religious dogma, than, you know, that more in line with that than it was his science. But
I
agree with you in the sense that spirituality, nobody picks up an axe and goes charging across the frozen tundra at another person in the name of spirituality. But they have done it and continue to do it in the name of religions.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe the idea that the new science has to be not a balance with the church, but a balance with natural spirituality and consciousness. Then you will see scientific breakthroughs on multiple dimensions.
Yes, you said something very valuable. Everybody needs to hear this. We need badly the distinction of spirituality and religion. Religion is about a particular method, whereas spirituality is innate aspects of ourselves. Spirituality is the idea of transformation or becoming ethical or developing the capacity to love. These are innate aspects of ourselves. We have that, we feel it, we get encouraged, inspired, intuit these things and live our life accordingly. This is spirituality. So if we could move on to, you know, this is the secular age where we try to separate science and religion. Religion should be separated because, of course, if we didn't, then all kinds of problems will arise. We don't have to go through that in this discussion. But on the other hand, we need spirituality badly for our own transformation and for the social transformation that we live in. These crisis conditions that we have gone through several times, they cannot be solved without some recognition of the need for our transformation. In the least, we need to transform or need to control greed, for example. Otherwise, our economies will just never get back together again. The capitalism, as we know it, is being destroyed by unleashed greed. And so, you know, how do we do it without the idea of transformation? we cannot do it. We cannot legalize greed away. I mean, that we have tried that many times, it just has not happened. It cannot happen because these brain circuits are very difficult to overcome that way. But with transformation, we're developing positive emotional brain circuits in our brain by actually working at positive emotions will do it. And so we need the concept of transformation. We need the concept of spirituality. We need the concept of ethics. And in order to bring these concepts, we've got to move to a post-secular age, post-secularism. This is an idea that I push whenever I get an opportunity. We've got to move to post-secularism, in which spirituality will no longer be separate. We can teach spirituality in our schools, in other words. What that means is that meditation should be allowed part of our curriculum. By excluding meditation, we are excluding creativity itself. All of our schooling goes towards do on the activity, and students have hardly any opportunity of being quiet. You talked about listening. How will they listening? How will they listen to the teacher without knowing how to listen? How to listen comes from the capacity of meditating. A relaxed meditation, where we just relax with ourselves in the state of our being, where quantum possibilities proliferate, and we then can process them, process a much bigger pool of possibility to choose from. And as a result, we not only develop the capacity for listening, we through listening, we can even become creative. And these things have to come to our schools. It will never come until we move on to post-secularism with a clear recognition that spirituality is as important as science is to us.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think at least some basic classes in meditation should be added to the high school curricula. We can have a lot of things change if we could get people to begin to listen, at least in a relaxed way. In a post-secular way, I think many, many things could change. Are we talking here about the coexistence, or shall we say dualism, between science and shall we call it post-secular religion?
Well, some dualism is inevitable because a religion, of course, is now a particular method to achieve spirituality. And the tendency that we have is to always simplify too much because you want to attract too many people. If you tell the truth, I sometimes joke about my books, why they don't sell very much. Because, they're not simple. As you said yourself, if you read these books, you get lost and you have to think about them. Every few pages. That is true. I'm not denying it. Because it has to be that way. Quantum physics and its message is not easy to understand, is not easy to manifest in our lives. But if on the other hand, eased a little, they're watered down, and people can understand the message, what you get is movies like The Secret, which takes part of the quantum language, the part that is easy to understand. Hey, you don't have to work, you just sit. That part is very easy. Not only very easy, people get immediately enthused because they are going to intend something and then just wait for it. And even if they don't get it, but they haven't lost anything because they didn't invest anything either. So, so the movie sold to millions of viewers, and the book likewise sold millions of copies. But what have they gained? This is the thing that I don't always understand. These religions have that nature of getting too many adherents, but what is gained by it? Except a few people get to feel that they have more power, a few people get to feel that they have more money, but these things are only very temporal. You haven't really gotten anything that is of value. This kind of tendency, however, is not going to go away, and therefore we got to have also the other side of it, which is totally objective, which will tell the truth as it is, as we can see. We cannot see the whole truth, but as we see, we must present it as accurately as possible with completely recognizing that there will be people who will water down the truth for their own personal benefit, for their own personal gain, and those things we can call religion. You know, this movie, The Secret, is starting a religion. And we have to accept that there will be some dualism always. We'll do science in the objective and the form that as we see the facts, as we see the theories, as we see them best. But there will be people who will be watering them down and create dualism where there is no dualism. And this is just human nature. We cannot prevent it. So we might as well accept it, and we'll try to bypass it as much as possible.
Well, I agree with that.
And
I agree with the idea that people should buy 2 million of your books and my books, and then they'll get the rest of the answers.
That would be nice. So, the Paradise Bookshop student. But, you know, whatever is whatever is. We cannot ignore human nature. Human nature is part of it, part of us, wants the easy way. And, you know, we just have to accept that there is that part of us until we evolve further. Now, there is going to be a stage of evolution in which this kind of inertia will give way. So let's just pray that it's hastened. That day of evolution, let it come sooner than later.
Yeah, I hope we evolve before the precipice comes.
Right.
One of the things that we, at least recently, openly profess in quantum physics is that looking affects things.
Yes.
And if we take this to the ultimate and we look out into the cosmos, or we look inward, or we look outward to God, what effect does looking at God have?
Well, if we look at God, what does looking at God mean? So first of all, you know, God is a concept, first of all. And then God is downward causation. And then God is undivided consciousness. So it depends on what we are looking for, what aspect of God we are looking for. So initially, when we look at concept. And that's the phase that we say we want to want God. This is a way of making fun of it. But really, most people who just deal with the concept of God, and that's the majority of God seekers. So you see how looking at God changes things. Because you look at God as a concept, and after a while of all this philosophical stuff that you read and so forth, you will want to know a little more. Not just wanting to want, and you are not satisfied with concepts anymore. So your looking at God has changed your aspect of God that you want to manifest. So at that stage, you want a little more of God to manifest in you, namely you want some access to downward causation. So your looking has changed your God from a God of concept to God of actual doing, bringing something, some transformation in your life. So then you look at God as downward causation for a while. And that will manifest creativity in your life. That will manifest transformation in your life. You manifest new brain circuits in your life. So you have now looked at God deeper. You have transformed a little bit. But after you have done that quite a while, the idea will grow, well, I have been there, done that. These brain circuits are already kind of balanced. Do I need to do anything? At that point, seeking of God, your looking at God has shifted again. Now you want to seek God just to be that perfection that God is. And that stage you are just looking for that way of living which is without any boundary, where the separateness never arises. You are always complete with God. And at that level, I think it's the final search, spiritual search for God begins, and this is where people become perfected themselves, like Jesus was, like Buddha was. Those are the journeys, the final journey of spirituality, where we don't want to manifest in this world anymore. We just surrender to God, a deep surrender. We give up the ego. We give up manifestation. We just become one with God consciousness.
Well, I understand
so looking
that. One with God consciousness. So what is unitive observation?
Well, so in this process, unity of observation comes. Those are the jumps of creativity, creative quantum leaps. So when we take that, then we observe with unity consciousness, right? So whenever we are observing the unity of consciousness, we are creating something new. Because only the unity of consciousness can choose the new. The ego, when we are in our individuality, we can only, just think about it, how can you choose something that you don't know? So ego only can choose from the known. Only in the unity of observation, when you have the capacity to observe from the unity consciousness, can we choose the new. That's what a creative insight is about. We have chosen a new meaning for what we are looking for. And in that new meaning then lies the journey of manifestation. So we manifest that new meaning. It could be a new meaning in a product. It could be a new meaning in the way I interact with the world, in my behavior. But whatever it is, it has come from that unity consciousness. So it will always take me towards the whole.
I like that. I like that a lot. And I think that that's key with the listening, too, because as you listen, you realize you don't know everything. And
right.
That's kind of humbling. And that kind
yes.
of takes the ego out of it, which allows
yes.
you to have this unitive observation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well spoken. And this ego out of it is very much part of the necessary. Although we, at this stage, we don't put ego out of it completely because we need the ego back again when we manifest. So manifestation stage and the preparation stage, we need the ego. So we keep the ego for those purposes. But in between, when we relax, we try to give up the ego or put the ego out of the way as much as possible. That is the idea of listening. That is the idea of openness. That is the idea of humility, recognizing that I really don't know. And in that don't know mind, which is what Zen Buddhists call don't know mind, that don't know mind is a very vital part of the creative process.
Wow. Well, I tell you, my mind is expanded from this interview. I really appreciate you coming on the program. Listen, if you want to know more, Earth Explorers, I know you haven't called in. I've been getting Skype messages all night long because nobody wants to interrupt the flow of information here. You can go to Dr. Goswami's website. It is amitgoswami.org. That's AmitGoswami.org. And all of his books are listed on there. There's The Physics of the Soul. There's several books which are well-written and open your mind. Are there any appearances that you have coming up pretty soon? Can people come and see you somewhere?
Yes, yes, in Los Angeles at the Hilton Hotel on May 8th and 9th. I'm doing a program for the Taksha University. This is a program of teaching about consciousness and psychology, integrative psychology. So those of you who are interested in consciousness studies, especially developing an integrative psychology for what you want to know about yourself, you know, psychology is very divided. It has behaviorism, it has Jungian psychology, it has depth psychology, Freudian psychology, psychoanalysis, it has transpersonal psychology, humanistic psychology, cognitive psychology. So how to put all these things together? If we have a materialist worldview, we can never do it. Quantum physics gives us a new worldview. We have talked about this for the last 3 hours, so you now understand how absolutely wonderful this worldview is in terms of its integrative capacity. So in this course, I'll teach you how to integrate the psychologies by using these quantum physical methods and theories and techniques, both theoretically and with some experiences as well. So please come. It's you can look for it in my website and also Taksha University, T-A-K-S-H-A. Taksha University. If you Google that, you will get their website. That also will have it's a Hilton Hotel in L.A. on May 8 and 9, Saturday and Sunday.
Very good. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program. I've been long looking forward to it. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I enjoyed enormously. Thank you for your wonderful questions and very insightful comments that you gave me the benefit to learn from also. Thank you.
I appreciate it. I look forward to meeting you someday. I wish I was in the L.A. area on the 9th. I have a previous engagement, but I have a lot of listeners there, and I'm sure you'll have a good turnout.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good luck. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good night. Earth Explorers, I want you to make sure that you keep up with X Squared Radio. Don't forget that we're on Twitter. We'll let you know all the events that are coming up. Please stay tuned to BBS Radio. Lots of outstanding hosts there. I think we're on the verge of really exploding. There's a possibility of even XM or Sirius channel, a consciousness channel, a paranormal channel that can go out there. I think the network has evolved over the last 5 years. Really an outstanding roster of world-class authorities, intelligences, and entertainers on the radio, and we really appreciate BBS Radio. We wouldn't be here without them, that's for sure. Appreciate our producers out there in Paradise, California. And we will see you next week here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.